Well, hello, friends. This is one of those programs which is a partial repeat of a former program. You would think that I would get my pilot's checklist in order. I've had programs in which I've had no audio, and more than once I've had programs in which I've had no video. The recent program 61 A and B, which is a two-hour program, had 50 minutes with quite good audio, but no video. And then around 50 minutes into the program, the audio came on. I think I finally realized what had happened. This time, the screen is definitely showing. So I thought, because it's important to see the text, I would repeat some of the first part of this program. Of course, it's not really a repetition at all, because I never say the same thing. So probably one listening to the audio in the supposedly video presentation, which I prepared a while ago, will derive from it certain information which may not be present on this one, which definitely does have the audio operating. Okay. Now, just want to make sure that all is in order here. Make sure my audio is in order this time. When we finished Esoteric Astrology 60, we were talking about the transitions between Aquarius to Leo to Aquarius. Aquarius begins with considerable superficiality, lack of depth, and a primitively decentralized attitude. In other words, there's a type of decentralization which is of value once you have achieved centralization, but there is a pre-centralization type of decentralization. It's a diffusion of consciousness and a lack of self-awareness. And so we talked about how Aquarius moves from that superficial condition to a deepening of self-consciousness in Leo, a profound interest in the self and its needs and wishes. The attention is concentrated on a relatively small ring pass knot in Leo, but at least one gets to know one's own energy system, one's tendencies, one's past, etc. Now, as I'm doing this, I'm quite aware that yes, perhaps both of these could be listened to. This one with video, but even the one without the video, because really it's different. The interplay goes on between Leo and Aquarius, and there comes a deepening of all qualities, and the superficialities disappear, until on the reversed wheel, counterclockwise, the intensive self-consciousness of Leo expands into the group awareness of Aquarius. The ring pass knot of self-awareness goes beyond the ring pass knot of one's normal energy system, and one is still focused as an individual. At least one can refer to oneself as an individual within the group, but the sense of one's identity now embraces the entire group. So it was this that led us into Esoteric Astrology number 61A, sends a video, but now we will go on. The individual becomes the universal, and I quoted the five mantras which were so utterly important in describing the progress of man. Lead us from darkness to light. Lead us from the unreal to the real. Lead us from death to immortality. Lead us from chaos to beauty. You can see how that correlates with the fourth ray. Lead us from the individual to the universal, while not denying either one. The thing that we are learning in the 61 A and B programs is that there is a kind of inclusiveness involved with Aquarius, where that which is apparently superseded is still inclusively retained. So although the universal supersedes the individual is retained. Although, let us say in Aquarius, the esoteric rulership of Jupiter supersedes the exoteric rulership of Uranus, the tendencies of that initial influence of Uranus in Aquarius is retained. There's also a later influence of Uranus in Aquarius, which is even more powerful and more occult. Okay. The individual becomes the universal. Well, really, the individual always is the universal. But it is a point of individuality within universality. The question is, does that point eventually dissolve into the one identity of the universal being? And I have a thought that indeed it does. Man alone and separative becomes mankind in his reactions and awareness. We are so sensitive to humanity as a whole that we don't just react to what impinges upon our individual energy system, but we react to that which impinges upon humanity as a whole. You know, just read the newspapers and see how you are reacting. Many things happening may not touch you as the individual, but do they touch you as humanity, and do you react in kind through a kind of loving, inclusive sympathy, empathy? Man alone and separative becomes mankind in his reactions and awareness. There's one soul, there are many eyes and sensory mechanisms through which the one soul looks or becomes sentient. And we are that one soul, and eventually our sentiency will extend to all of humanity, as is the case with the great Lord, the Christ, and other great empaths. Ramakrishna was one. Man alone and separative becomes mankind in his reactions and awareness, and yet at the same time preserves his individuality. The individuality is an emanation which focuses as a point. Really, there's only one point, and all points are part of the one point. And gradually, all points are relinquished and abstracted into the one point, which is the universal logos itself, until the one point itself dissolves back into the ultimate be-ness, who is not a being, but is being itself. So Christ can attune in this empathic manner. He's psychically in the consciousnesses of all of the human beings, and what allows him to do this is the high cultivation of the Neptunian quality of identification, which is the case with all those masters who are walking the path of earth service. They have developed the power of identification to a very great extent. Individual advanced in Aquarius is no longer just a human being. He is that, but not just individually self-centered and separative. His eyes are no longer upon his lower personal self, but he becomes humanity itself, a very great state of identification, and one I think that we should all practice. It's not just a question of the love of humanity, it's the question of being humanity and identifying with humanity, and I always like to say identifying as humanity, because with seems to suggest the duality of this and that, this with that. But this as that suggests identicality. But becomes humanity itself, losing his personal identity in the good of the whole, willing to submerge it, willing to subjugate it, willing to put it in second place compared to the good of the whole. In Aquarius, we have the greatest good of the greatest number. It's one of those signs, a very Jupiterian idea, the greatest good of the greatest number. And Jupiter is that esoteric ruler in Aquarius. He loses his personal identity in the good of the whole, yet retains his spiritual identity, which is the identity, essentially, of the monad, that part of us which is a pure being, no matter what happens in all of our energy system, it can be sacrificed to the good of the spirit as it attempts through its mechanisms to express divine purpose. So he's no longer considering himself just a personality. He does have a personality, of course, but he is ultimately the monad, which is one with the spirit. Aquarians are very good initially at self-service. They shower upon themselves all the values of the environment, and they, responding to the mantram, let desire and form be ruler, they gather to themselves and serve themselves with all the good, the relative good which they can touch. But from self-service, the advanced Aquarian, he proceeds to world service. It takes a long time. It's connected at least with the second, with the third degree, where the world disciple appears. World service and world discipleship go together, and yet is always the individualized son of God until after the third initiation. I would say very much until the fourth initiation. This is my impression. At the third initiation, we get that great sense of unity, and we overcome the illusion of separativeness, but we are still very much individualized with all of our gifts, and relinquishing those gifts for a still greater purpose may be difficult even to the third degree initiate, the idea of going through the eye of the needle. So from self-service, this developed Aquarian proceeds to world service, and yet is always the individualized son of God until after the third degree. Well, even after the third degree, the monad, in a way, is individual. I'd like to say indivisible. That's a good way of describing the word individual. So there is individuality retained after the third degree, and I think, in a way, all the way up the scale, even the great universal logos is an individual, but the emphasis is not there. And all of the gifts of individuality are offered to the still greater hierarch, which serves a still greater hierarch, and so forth. The emphasis is by no means upon ahamkara. Well, let's say that sense of I-ness, that ahamkara, is really broken at the fourth initiation, but at the third one already sees that it is quite illusory, and that universality is where the attention belongs. So Tibetan has emphasized that we move from the individual to the universal back and forth, and both are retained simultaneously. The fact that one is individualized, I say, is not the main factor in consciousness, but the fact that one is at one with all humanity and with all, this is the main factor. As one studies these 12 signs, it is interesting to trace the relation of consciousness to the preceding sign and to the succeeding sign. Now this, when you have two planets, 30 degrees apart, one in one sign, one in the next sign, is called a semi-sextile. These two adjacent signs are contrasting and yet supplementary. Contrasting and yet supplementary. Let's just say that if we're looking at Capricorn to Aquarius, they comprise 60 degrees. It's a sextile. And the two together form a unit, just the way Aquarius and Pisces form a unit. All the adjacent signs form a unit. And from a certain perspective, we can even look at the angles of 150 degrees, which use the same symbol as the semi-sextile, but inverted, with a flat line above. And they, too, form important supplementary units. So there's always a relationship in terms of consciousness to the preceding sign and to the succeeding sign. In the case of Aquarius, this relationship is with Capricorn and Pisces. DK says it's true of all the signs, but it's peculiarly so in connection with Aquarius. The material earthly quality of Capricorn becomes dissolved into the air. Aquarius, one of the foremost air signs, foremost at this time, because it is the major sign ruling the smaller equinoctial age, the precessional age, and the larger age of 25,000 years. It's as if the cosmic physical body of the solar logos or planetary logos has to be dissolved into the cosmic ethers. And the cosmic ethers are in a strong way ruled by Aquarius and by its major planet, Uranus. I say its major planet because even though it's the orthodox ruler, or exoteric ruler, it is also the foremost veiled hierarchical ruler. So as we will see, it has a double influence. So this earthly influence of Capricorn becomes transmuted, elevated, etherealized, dissolved into the air. And the air is the Buddhic plane, and the air, in a way, is all of the cosmic ethers. So we may reach the pinnacle of achievement in relation to the lower three worlds in Capricorn, but in a certain respect, we take off from that mountain peak and rise into the air. The one who stands on the mountaintop has two choices. He really needs to descend into the valleys and to serve, and that is Aquarius, but as he descends to serve, he also appreciates the higher ethers. And it's as if an aspect of his nature has been transported and dissolved into the higher ethers. Okay. It's amazing having to repeat things, you know, but what I discover is that one learns even more going over these words in the secondary manner of pondering them, going over and over them until more and more of the intuition seeps in. This is a good method. So study groups are a good way to go. Get together with your conscientious, studential friends and pore deeply over these sentences which Master DK has given us as he attempts to put the ageless wisdom into the limited form of our words. The individual fish of the other sign, that's Pisces, starting out as this non-soul conscious fish sent forth by the soul itself, the fish goddesses. The individual fish of the other sign becomes eventually the soul, self-aware. The soul quality emerges, and this is happening in Aquarius. And so we're moving backwards, of course. We're going from Pisces to Aquarius. And on the reversed wheel, it demonstrates as the pervasiveness of wisdom, Pisces, and the universal love of the truly developed Aquarian. Sometimes one might think these are even reversed. One might think the Aquarian is wise and the Pisces is full of love. But DK puts it this way, and these are both Jupiterian qualities, Jupiter and Neptune, in a way, together. The pervasiveness of wisdom in Pisces is a combination of Neptune pervasiveness, Jupiterian expansiveness, and Jupiterian wisdom. The wisdom, the plane of wisdom is the Buddhic plane, and both Neptune and Jupiter, as rulers of Pisces, are correlated with the Buddhic plane. Pisces is one of the intuitive signs we know, and through Jupiter and Neptune, this becomes possible. The universal love of the truly developed Aquarian, truly developed, relates to the esoteric ruler of Aquarius by Jupiter. The universal love of the truly developed Aquarian. Aquarius is related to the heart, just as Leo is. It's related to the circulatory system and the sense of the way the heart reaches to all the aspects of any wholeness. So most initiates, we are told, end their career as human beings in the sign Aquarius, demonstrating a form of love, universal love. It's a great concluding virtue with regard to the family of humanity. The fourth initiation, even the fifth initiation taken in Aquarius, relating a man as a world server to the hierarchy. But in Pisces, this quality of will and total self-effacement in the presence of purpose is added, and the wisdom of the ages comes to him. So let us remember this as we look at developing Pisceans who have that power of synthesis. Pervasiveness of wisdom characterizes them, and they see things synthetically. And Aquarius is reaching out and participating with all life, vitally invested in all of life, and expressing a quality of universal love. If we think about it, Leo is a very important sign to our solar logos, obviously, because the sun rules Leo and Aquarius, therefore. The opposite sign to Leo has to be very important to our solar logos, who is the universal being, as far as we are concerned, and his quality is love, wisdom. So it is the love nature of the solar logos working on his, well, he has his second initiation, but he's a secondary soul, secondary personality. And he is a heart of love, and that universal love is pouring through Aquarius just as it is Leo. It seems that our solar logos is somehow on the Leo-Aquarius axis. At the present time, of course, that axis will also shift, but there's something about Leo-Aquarius which is very important to our solar logos in the long term. On the wheel, as it rolls onward into illusion in the clockwise manner, it's called the wheel of the personality, the wheel of form. The superficiality and the airy nature of the undeveloped Aquarian deepens. Well, you know, they go everywhere, they talk to everyone, they are connected, but they do not get into the psychological and energetic depths of others. So Aquarius needs deepening. So this deepens gradually into the concrete, rocky material nature of Capricorn. We're going clockwise now, and we're saying that there is progress occurring on the wheel of involution, which is the clockwise wheel, the wheel of form. And so, you know, density and rockiness and heaviness and earthiness can be an obstacle themselves, but they can be an improvement over this superficial airiness of the undeveloped Aquarian. The average man in Aquarius puts all his wares into the window. He has a very exteriorized condition of consciousness, I say. It's a great tendency towards extroversion, towards pressing the inner content forward and outward. And, well, what you see is what you get. I mean, you're pretty much understanding the whole individual, the whole undeveloped individual. He wants to show you, he wants to broadcast to you all that he is, and he does not leave anything in reserve. The Tibetan says, and often in the room behind the window, there is little to be found. Imagine you went into a store and you thought from looking at the window that there would be similar things in the rest of the store, and you find out that the entire display is all there is in the store. So one is then going to be a little disappointed with the lack of reserves, the lack of depth there. The broadcasting mentality, I call it, the extreme extroversion. Esoterically, the developed Aquarian puts all he has into the water pot, storing it there for service and giving it freely on demand to meet a need. Well, I want to go back here for a second to the idea of extroversion and introversion. They rule two great phases of consciousness, with the extroverted phase being the less developed phase and lasting the greater proportion of human evolution. It means that the consciousness is directed outward towards the so-called not-self, and is preoccupied with physical, emotional, and mental personal factors, and not with the true subjectivity of the soul. The stage of true introversion is involvement in the true subjectivity of the soul. Now, during those long phases, there can be personalities that are either very much pressing forward or very much withdrawn. In other words, you can have an externally oriented person in terms of his phase of consciousness who has a personality which is largely out there, or one that is withdrawn. Now, that the deeper thing is whether the person is in the introverted stage of consciousness over the long term. This superficial question of whether he is outgoing or withdrawn is a secondary matter. The same can be true when we've reached that stage of subjective orientation. You can have people who have great external skills. They can exteriorize much of what they learn within themselves, but they are definitely in the introverted, inward-turning stage of consciousness, or they can be also very subjectively focused and in their own inner world and not worrying about externalizing that. But there are people who do attempt to externalize the inner subjective state of consciousness, and in a way, that is what is required of disciples today and of the hierarchy during this phase we call the externalization of the hierarchy. Esoterically, the developed Aquarian puts all he has, everything is used, into the water pot, which is his causal body in many respects, storing it there for service and giving it freely on demand to meet the need. That's the question of asking nothing for the separated self. The great joy is to give. It is better to give than to receive. That's a very Aquarian kind of statement. Pour forth, and then there will be a replenishment according to the law. If one gives what one has, one cannot help but be replenished. I like to think of it in these terms. To those who give all is given. Okay, so, and then there's this question of freely given. Well, the hierarchy is not asking a fee, are they? They do expect us to do something with what they've given, but they freely give of their knowledge and wisdom and love and all of this at great sacrifice. Okay, how are we doing here? Okay. The sign Aquarius is a dual sign and signifies two vibrations. We have the two wavy lines, one above the other, one perhaps representing the world of archetypes and the other that reflection of the archetype which is induced in the lower worlds. It's as if one perhaps could be considered cosmic etheric and the other cosmic dense, or simply etheric and dense. The etheric body is an archetypal realm. The cosmic ethers are certainly archetypal realms. And within their corresponding dense bodies, they have to induce a similar vibration. It is here that its relation to Pisces emerges, for just as Pisces on the wheel of illusion, the mutable cross, stands for substance and bondage, with the soul rebelling, the soul in bondage to substance, often. In Aquarius, substance and the anima mundi, or imprisoned soul, begin to work in mutual tolerance. So, in the Piscean age, we've had a very strong cleavage between substance matter and soul consciousness. And this is not going to be the case in the age of Aquarius, because, as we know, the Aquarius rules the lowest of the creative hierarchies, which is the sort of substantial creative hierarchy, the blinded lives, as they are called. Let's see, take a look at this one here. Right down here, Aquarius. The planet, hierarchical, the moon, color, violet. Elemental lives, the baskets of nourishment, the blinded lives. Yes, so there will be mutual tolerance of spirit and matter, of consciousness and form during the Aquarian Age, where there tended to be a kind of a great cleavage, a rejection of matter by consciousness during the Age of Pisces. The soul realized it was in bondage to substance matter and rebelled against that. But in Aquarius, there's going to be a greater cooperation, greater mutual respect, and there will be much more work on the regeneration of substance under Aquarius and the seventh ray. Pretty much during the age of Pisces, we could let the outer world go, and we simply wanted relief from that outer world. And so under the sixth ray, we kicked the earth as if it were a ball upon the playing field. This is one of the things said to the sixth ray lord by the other ray lords. Why do you kick the earth as if it's a ball on a playing field? Because there is a spurning and a hatred of form and the realization of one's bondage to form. But of course, if matter-substance can be reconditioned, then the immersed soul is no longer in bondage. And Aquarius has this magical scientific ability to master substance so that the soul and spirit can express wisely and lovingly through that substance. So they're beginning to work the unconscious soul, and even the conscious soul, because the anima mundi has many different aspects to it, begin to work with substance intelligently. There's a lot of intelligence in the sign Aquarius. It has the third ray, it has the fifth ray, And that's not so much the case with Pisces, where Mercury is in its fall, although there is a very great wisdom, pervasive wisdom, which is not necessarily the same as knowledge, right? Okay, so whereas in Pisces, on the mutable cross and the wheel of illusion, we have substance and bondage, the binding of the soul. In Aquarius, we have cooperation. And in the higher Aquarian individual, soul and spirit are expressing themselves through substance. Aquarius is very high. Aquarius is also representing that which is relatively low and the accommodation between them. There is consequently an astrological relation between the band of stars in the constellation Pisces. It's one of the extra, it's also called an extra zodiacal constellation, the band. It's sometimes separated out from Pisces altogether. But there's consequently an astrological relation between the band of stars in the constellation Pisces, which unites the two fishes. It's a unitive band, a magnetic band, and the quality and nature of Aquarius, which relates and binds together into one working and synthetic whole. It relates and it binds. Of course, the word binding suggests again Pisces. They both have this unitive factor. So they're both involved with the factor of cohesion, although that cohesion is rather involuntary in Pisces. First, the soul is involuntarily bound to the form and substantial nature, and later that form, substantial nature, whatever it may will, it gives itself up to the soul, and then it has no will of its own anymore. The soul will has taken over, and the lower elemental lives are in bondage through a decision of the reoriented personality in relation to the higher self, in relation to the higher part of man. Anyway, they're both working with binding, with magnetism, with attraction, and hence, in a way, with the second ray and under the influence of Jupiter. Jupiter is ruling in both signs in various places. They both have the power of cohesion. The Aquarian recognizes the bond which holds all together subjectively and in truth. You know, as I'm doing this for the second time now, certain sentences stand out to me, and this is certainly one of them. The Aquarian recognizes the bond which holds all together subjectively and in truth. And in truth, that's how things really are, without distortion. All things are held together. There are no other selves. There is only the whole. In unison, let the group perceive the triad shining forth, dimming the light of soul and blotting out the light of form. The macrocosmic whole is all there is. Let the group perceive that whole, and then no longer use the thought, my soul and thine. That's very Aquarian in a certain respect. It's the fifth of the advanced rules in the rays and the initiation. So Aquarius recognizes, and I would say magically and scientifically works with, the bond that holds all together in subjectivity, recognizes the universal soul, recognizes the anima mundi, and the higher aspects of the anima mundi, which are superconscious. Whilst in Pisces, the energy of relationship constitutes an imprisoning band which confines and holds captive. So this is the emphasis in Aquarius, so often signified by the word freedom, liberty, revolution, breaking free. This is what the Aquarius tends to emphasize, where oftentimes the Piscean will emphasize obedience, discipline, self-abnegation, putting oneself into disciplined confinement in order to achieve a still deeper type of liberation. So in the Piscean age, we subjected ourselves to much denial of personal freedom so that we could achieve a higher spiritual freedom. But the demand for liberation and freedom, even of the personality, is greater in the age of Aquarius. And this we've seen with Uranus in Aries right now and all of the various revolutions being conducted around the world, people paying the price for those revolutions. They take their idealism to the street and they demand freedom against the Saturnian repressive powers. So anyway, we have binding, bondage, cohesion, but of two different kinds when we compare Aquarius and Pisces. Think this out, he says. Well, we've been attempting to do that. It is an error to consider the margin of contact between two signs in the passage of the sun to be in the nature of hard and fast frontiers or set boundary lines. Well, the sun is not really passing. That is an illusion. But as we move from sign to sign, the sun appears to be moving in relation to that part of the orbit of the Earth. It's really the orbit which contains the movement. The sun is not moving, this we know. But let's just say we're dealing with something very important here. You don't just suddenly end being a Pisces and start being an Aries, let us say. There's an overlap. That overlap, I have thought, is sometimes 2.5 degrees on either side of the sign, when the qualities of the two neighboring signs show themselves wherever you are born within those 5 degrees. You can be born, right on the cusp. Let's say that's the most blended situation. You will show signs of Pisces and signs of Aries as well, and there's no use trying to pretend that you are just one or the other. Technically, you may be one or the other in terms of the mathematics of the astrology, but you will probably show the signs of the qualities of the sign in which you are born and the adjacent sign. This overlap is true for precessional ages of 2,500 years. There's a 500-year overlap, tells the Tibetan, and for greater precessional ages of 25,000 years, there's a 5,000-year overlap. Probably, 2,500 on either side, or for the lesser precessional age, to 250 years, and somewhat for the 2.5 degrees. Well, it's not exactly the same, but let's just say that on either side of the boundary of two signs in the yearly cycle, there is that overlap period. So we have to realize that all of nature proceeds gradually and there are no sudden dramatic changes here between areas of energy. No rigid lines of demarcation, he says, separating two entirely different areas. They're not entirely different, especially in the overlapping area. They have shared qualities. So the early Aretian is likely to be more Piscean than the middle Aretian. And the later Piscean is liable to be... I said the early Aretian is liable to be more Piscean than the later Aretian, and the later Piscean is liable to be more Aretian than the middle Piscean. Interestingly enough, the last degrees of Pisces, the last 10 degrees, are ruled by Mars, we're told, and that brings a blending of the Martian energy as we move into Aries, so they both are sharing that Martian quality. There are no rigid lines of demarcation separating two entirely different areas of experience and consciousness upon the solar path. We have to have a subtle consciousness to perceive this. It only appears to be so. And that's part of the great illusion. The illusion is caused by the concrete mind with all of its tendencies to divide into hard and fast segments. And we do overcome illusion produced by the concrete mind through the power of the intuition, which tends to eradicate these artificially or mind-created boundaries. Einstein was a Pisces, strongly Neptunian, Jupiterian in his nature. He says, look, when you go out into outer space, you look down, where are all of the lines that demarcate countries and states? No, these are constructs of the concrete mind, and they are not real. So we overcome that illusion of separation by looking at the one Earth from a distance in space. I think it's a very clear analogy. The rulers of Aquarius are of a peculiar interest. Let's see how I'm doing here, because I want to see how far I can go before... the trouble is when you do things over again, sometimes you're not exactly connecting with how you did it before. Well, we will see. We will see. As I say, this one's entirely different from the one I did before. So my advice is to listen to both, because different things will be derived. Although I am speaking more quickly in this repeat. Okay, there are no rigid lines of demarcation. The rigid lines of demarcation are produced by the concrete mind. We end illusion through the power of the soul, which is unitive, overcoming through the influence of Jupiter and Neptune, all of those lines created by lower Mercury and Saturn and so forth. The rulers of Aquarius are of a peculiar interest. Well, aren't they all, I think, but okay, maybe a very special kind of interest here. They constitute an effective group of planets. These planets work together as something of a group. There are many lines of cooperation between the planetary gods, and when they happen to rule in different ways the same sign, they are certainly cooperating in a group form. Let's see how this would work here. How would I put that down? Okay, let's see. The three are cooperating, but really more than three, because you can't count the moon. The moon is veiling Vulcan, Neptune, and Uranus. So you've really got Uranus twice, and you've got Jupiter, Vulcan, and Neptune. All four of them are operative in Aquarius, an effective group of planets, and brings in the influence of the seventh, second, and fourth rays. Note these rays because the Tibetan says something very interesting about them. These are preeminently the rays which determine the final stages of man's progress as well as the initial stages. Being more potent at the beginning of the involutionary path. Note, even the beginning of the involutionary path, even though some say there were only 8 signs or 10 signs, and at the end of the evolutionary path than they are in the middle period. Why should this be so? Well, the seventh ray unites spirit and matter at the end of the evolutionary path. The second ray fulfills the purpose of our planetary logos and even our solar logos with his second ray soul, making love, wisdom, the predominating, integrating quality, integrating all the other rays. And the fourth ray brings one onto the Buddhic plane, where the human spiritual hierarchy is supposed to express. We may be monads, deriving from the second cosmic ether, or the monadic plane, at least in the short term, but eventually we have to learn how to express buddhically as links between the higher and lower kingdoms and in the fourth kingdom of nature in the three lower worlds. So, indeed, seventh, second, and fourth rays, although I might not have thought that, I might have, looked for the first ray somehow at the end of everything, but these are the rays which determine the final stages, seventh, second, and fourth, to be remembered. And look at this, humanity will, instead of being an example of the fourth and fifth rays as it is now, will later be an example of the second and fourth rays. So the developed human kingdom will have the second and fourth rays, and in full manifestation through the seventh ray. Now, why should these operate in the beginning of the involutionary path? Well, the seventh ray is correlated with the dense physical body where the human consciousness is focused for a long, long time. That first petal takes a long, long time to open, and we're dealing with the seventh sphere, physically and etherically. When it comes to the second, we're dealing with the growing sensitivity of the newly individualized unit. So sensitizing early man is of paramount importance. And when it comes to the fourth ray, well, it is the ray that rules humanity altogether, and it shows this path of extreme conflict and friction, which leads to sensitization. Sometimes you have to bang into something else before you can touch something else more gently and more sensitively. You know, in the beginning, impacts are fairly aggressive and violent compared with what they are later. So these are the rays which determine the final stages and the beginning stages. And like I said before, both Aquarius and Pisces are involved in these initial involutionary stages, even though there may be zodiacs in which those two signs do not have a full spiritual impact upon humanity. They determine the final stages and happenings of the path of initiation, DK says here. The seventh ray brings into expression upon the physical plane the major pairs of opposite spirit and matter. And finally, at the end of evolution, it is a question of spirit entirely infusing matter with the individualized soul no longer present. There is a pervasive, universal soul involved. So spirit has the quality of soul and infuses matter. And it relates them to each other. So it is a consummatory, a final kind of stage where spirit and matter are rightly related to each other, being brought to that condition through the mediatorship of soul, but now that type of individualized soul is no longer needed, producing eventually one functioning whole. When spirit and matter can truly relate, the whole can function as one being, totally effectively and in an integrated manner. All fragmentation is overcome, the whole is seen as one, the whole can function as one. So that's climactic for the seventh ray. That's what DK says. The second ray gives soul expression and spiritual consciousness, and also the power to pour out love and wisdom upon the earth, which is certainly the objective of our planetary logos with his second ray soul, and the solar logos as well, whilst the fourth ray indicates the field of service, which is, in a way, humanity for human beings, and the mode of attaining that goal, which is harmony, harmony through conflict. This mode or method, says the Tibetan, is that of conflict and struggle in order to reach harmony, and thus express all truly human characteristics, linking characteristics, for the fourth ray and the fourth grade of hierarchy constitute essentially one expression of truth. Eventually humanity, with its presently fourth ray soul, is to learn to express its innate characteristics through the substance of the human race and the substance of the lesser kingdoms. There's Mars in the sixth ray, there's Mercury in the fourth ray. They both engage in conflict, but the kind of conflict of the sixth ray is the conflict between ideals in which generally one victorious ideal dominates another, and the conflict conducted under Mercury in the fourth ray is to reach harmony and mutual respect between the two aspects of one whole. So the victory is in the harmony and not in the overcoming of one ideal by another, even though conflict demonstrates in both, and we really do need to see how the conflicts between the fourth ray and the sixth ray are different, because if we judge by superficial appearance, they both may look very conflicted, but eventually there is reconciliation with the fourth ray, but with the sixth ray, initially there is not reconciliation. One is reminded of Alexander the Great, who had a lot of fourth ray, probably a fourth ray personality, and whoever he conquered, he assimilated and even imitated and made a reconciliation with. So he was not interested in a strictly dominant position. He was interested in harmonizing the one who had been conquered to the conqueror. And oftentimes the conqueror absorbs so much of that which had been conquered as to change its nature. So it was really fourth-ray solution. Some astrologers assign Saturn as one of the rulers of Aquarius. It's the old assignment, apparently, and if you take a good look at people born in Aquarius, even their physiognomy, you will see sometimes the narrowing of the face under the influence of Saturn. DK says Alan Leo is one of those who assign Saturn as a ruler, but he has a different point of view about why this should be so. DK says, I would point out that in this case he is dealing entirely with the progress of the ordinary man upon the wheel of life. So Saturn is operative as a ruler in Aquarius in relation to the ordinary man. I mean, perhaps there was Aquarius in the early days, 500 years ago, 1,000 years ago, but there wasn't much Uranus, was there? Because people were responding to Aquarius in a more ordinary manner, still a circumscribed manner. Later the Uranian Aquarian began to emerge, but at first the Saturnian. Although the Saturnian influence goes to the first decanate of Aquarius, and there it has to do with disciples in relation to the first decanate and all the kinds of difficulties they encounter when first entering the sign of Aquarius, which calls for a wider participation in the group and the giving up of the prerogatives of the individual, which is usually a struggle. So anyway, Alan Leo believed that Saturn was involved there. And the Saturn, which he senses, says the Tibetan, is ruling Aquarius, is the Saturnian influence of Capricorn, in which Saturn governs in two fields. So basically what he's saying, there's an interrelationship between juxtaposed signs, and their qualities interpenetrate each other. They flow into each other. They influence each other. Here he's talking about an influence forward on the counterclockwise wheel from Capricorn to Aquarius, but there is also the possibility of influence on the clockwise wheel going apparently backwards, in the not in the true order of the signs. So he's saying this Saturnian influence is really kind of a hangover or a leftover from Capricorn, which has bled into or pervaded, somehow entered the Aquarian field as a kind of a momentum, a forward momentum carrying on into the next sign. We could look at every sign of the zodiac and we could wonder the extent to which the ruler of the previous sign somehow carries over into the succeeding sign. That would be an interesting kind of study, but here Saturn is definitely assigned by many. Well, they didn't know there was anything beyond Saturn. The initiates knew, perhaps, but they didn't. The astrologers didn't know, and they needed to assign different planets to the various signs, and Saturn seemed natural to the Aquarian, although there are many aloof, cold, distant, abstracted qualities in Aquarius which suggest Saturn. On the reversed wheel, counterclockwise wheel, the Saturnian influence exhausts itself in Capricorn. That's interesting. There's a double rulership there in Capricorn, and everything that it could do, it does do. And the man is freed from karma because he's paid his karma. He's climbed the mountain of karma. He's put karma underfoot, at least in a human sense, you know, because really karma goes on. It simply means action. It's the bed you make and have to lie in. You know, it is the what you have created, and because you have created it, you're within your creation, and that is exposure to karma. On the reverse wheel, the Saturnian influence exhausts itself in Capricorn, and the man is then free from that phase of karma. The word freedom is there again. He becomes the free agent under Uranus, and says the Tibetan, and needs no presentation of opportunity, for he stands a free initiate. Opportunity, as the Tibetan conceives it, is usually some sort of obstacle which in the overcoming strengthens the resourcefulness and the power of the one who overcomes. So he does not need to face his past and the conditions which he has created in the past. Karma is somewhat a selectivity from the past which is presented not all at once but at moments when the present consciousness can best marshal its resources to overcome and master those previous tendencies. So opportunity is not just the open door of Jupiter as we sometimes like to think of it. Oh, you know, everything's going my way, what opportunity I have, but obstacles are possibilities, says Master Moria, and we are presented with difficulties which will increase our resourcefulness and double our abilities or maybe multiply them many times because we'll have to use our will and our conscious thinking power to overcome these obstacles which are really hidden opportunities. So, but the man who is operating under Uranus in Aquarius is the free initiate. He stands free. He's a true master mason, at least of the third degree, and even of the fourth and fifth degree. The true master mason is the master, and can then proceed with world service, undeterred and held back by no thought of self or selfish desire. The Uranian Aquarian is the world server. He is not inhibited by a lot of unfinished business which Saturn, for which Saturn demands a rectification. Saturn holds you to the task until you finish. That's the amazing thing about Saturn. It is a finisher. So is Capricorn. And there is no need for the developed Aquarian to deal with that anymore, although he does carry the burden of the world, the burden of humanity. And when you think of carrying burdens, you really do think of Saturn, because it is a planet related to that metal, which is heavy, heavy as lead. It's a conventionally heavy metal. I mean, we didn't know of other and heavier metals at the time. So the leadenness of Capricorn, and Saturn, rather, is found in Aquarius, and there the one who carries the burden of humanity and the burden of the world is lifting the sometimes heavy as lead humanity onto his shoulders and attempting to uplift and support. So there, this question of the weight lifter, which is sometimes found in Aquarius, seems very related to its Saturnian rulership, and not so much to the Uranian, which rulership, which seems to have wings, seems to be able to fly to the cosmic ethers, seems to be able to take off, to aviate. As a matter of fact, of course, Uranus rules aviation, and Saturn certainly does not. You have to master the lower Saturnian laws in order to aviate. So we can take off into the air via Uranus, but we're left into the earthly condition via Saturn. But you can still see that Aquarius being a burden-bearing sign is related to Saturn, because there are burdens to be borne, and the power of Saturn to stay with the bearing of burdens is really strongly Aquarian in nature. Well, okay. Looks like I have spoken rapidly here, and probably somehow included in this lesser amount of time, but not too much lesser, everything that I spoke of in the earlier 61A session, which was not video, but I will say that 61A2 is videoed and has come to the same place, approximately page, I think it says page 130, yes, 138. So, although I rather dreaded doing this again, I learned quite a bit myself while doing it, and was able to put together certain ideas, perhaps in a more coherent form than at the first. So, we are now at the point where we can read the Great Invocation together, as we always do, and I will send this on to Brett and those who are helping. And you will receive two versions of this introduction to Aquarius, one with video, one without, but you will find that they are rather different. So perhaps it pays to listen to both, although there will be some repetition. Okay, here we go. Great Invocation. From the point of light within the mind of God, let light stream forth into the minds of men, let light descend on earth. From the point of love within the heart of God, let love stream forth into the hearts of men, may Christ return to earth. From the center where the will of God is known, let purpose guide the little wills of men, the purpose which the masters know and serve. From the center which we call the race of men, let the plan of love and light work out, and may it seal the door where evil dwells. Let light and love and power restore the plan on earth. Okay, friends, so I hope I can get all my ducks in a row. We will continue with Esoteric Astrology Adventure number 62, and now we've covered 61A twice, and 61B is videoed, although it may be a little inconvenient for you to reach that point. Well, really all you have to do is click on it and it will immediately jump over the area which had no video and will go to the point where it says, is my screen showing? All right. Thank you for joining, and we will be seeing you soon for 62, Esoteric Astrology Adventure 62, and we will be working in Aquarius. All the best until then. Bye-bye.